Hi, I'm Sean.
I'm Anna.
Welcome to the Blue Sky Podcast, the podcast for the Cambridge Student Science Communication Society. On the show today, I'll be talking to glaciologist Dr. Alison Banwell about climate science and the realities of polar fieldwork. But first, Emma talks to geneticist Dr. Elizabeth Murchison. Emma?
Yes, thanks, Sean. So, Liz is a British-Australian scientist based in Cambridge. She did her PhD at Cool Spring Harbour in the US, before a postdoc at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, and that's when she started her work on transmissible cancers. She now leads the transmissible cancer group at the Cambridge Vet School. I've actually known her for many years. She's a really, really lovely person, and I think a great role model for young women in science. And her work is truly fascinating, so I hope you will enjoy the interview. Okay, so today I'm sat with Elizabeth Murchison, who works at the Vet School in Cambridge. Liz, thanks for joining us. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here.
So you work, amongst other things, on clonally transmissible cancers in Tasmanian devils. So starting off with an easy question, what's a Tasmanian devil? Because I think a lot of people think of cartoon character.
Yeah, a lot of people think of cartoon characters, but actually Tasmanian devils are the world's largest carnivorous marsupial. So they're about the size of a small dog, and they're black coloured apart from a kind of nice white stripe on their neck. And they make a terrifying screaming sound. I'd recommend maybe Googling it just to hear it. And they're only found in Tasmania, which is an island just to the south of mainland Australia. It's about the size of the Republic of Ireland, and it's the only place where they're found.
Do you know how many there are at the moment?
There's probably a few tens of thousands, maybe, but certainly less than 100,000.
So the particular cancer that you study was, I think, first described in the
1996,
so quite recently. And since then, we've seen a dramatic reduction in the Tasmanian devil population.
Mm-hmm.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I think where it was first found, it's decreased by something like 90%.
The population has almost disappeared in some of those areas where the disease was first seen.
Could you tell us a bit more about what makes this particular cancer special?
So let me tell you a little bit about kind of cancer more generally, and then kind of explain about why this devil cancer is so unique and different. So I guess we all know that cancer occurs when a normal cell in the body gets some mutations which make it into a cancer cell. And once it's a cancer cell, it starts proliferating and invading host tissues. And sometimes the cancer cells can spread through the body in a process known as metastasis. But crucially, cancer doesn't normally survive beyond the body of the individual whose cells it first came from. So cancer cells belong to our own body, even though they're kind of mutated versions of our own cells. They are still our own cells originally. What's happened with the Tasmanian devils is that they have a transmissible cancer, which is a cancer which can jump between hosts. If you imagine for a moment that there was a devil, a Tasmanian devil, a single Tasmanian devil that was living probably back in the 1990s, that single Tasmanian devil got a cancer just like any other cancer. One of their cells went wrong, got mutations, and grew into a cancer. But then, unlike other cancers, that cancer didn't just die together with its host. It actually acquired some adaptations to jump into another host, most likely by biting. Devils, they bite each other a lot, particularly around the face. This cancer, it grows on their face. It causes hideous tumours, usually on the face or inside the mouth. And they're also very aggressive. They grow very fast, these tumours. What happens is that when the devils bite each other, they transplant cancer cells from one devil to another. So that one Tasmanian devil, which we happen to know was a female that got a cancer back in the 1990s, her cancer is still alive today, having spread through the devil population by biting. And in a sense, this cancer has metastasized through an entire population of individuals.
So the story for the devils became even more complicated, I think, a few years ago when you described a second clonally transmissible cancer amongst the devil population.
Yeah, so that was a huge surprise, probably one of the biggest surprises of my life, because I should mention that I'm actually from Tasmania, and I've been working with Tasmanian Devils for quite a long time now. And whenever we talk about this transmissible cancer and explain it to people, it's always, we always describe it as being a kind of terrible piece of bad luck for the Devils, and mm-hmm. just a really strange fluke of nature that this cancer acquired the ability to jump from one animal to another. Because I should mention, we might come to it later, that this type of phenomenon is extremely rare in nature. Yeah. But the really surprising thing that happened back in 2014, a couple of years ago, was that we were doing some kind of routine work on the devil cancer in a kind of area just in the south of Tasmania, mm-hmm. actually very close to where my family lives. And some of my colleagues found a tumour which didn't really look like the tumours that we normally see. And we did some more investigations, and it turned out that this second tumour was genetically completely distinct from the first one, and actually carries a Y chromosome, which indicates that it came from a male, mm-hmm. and we know that the first one came from a female. And so what it actually is a second transmissible cancer, which causes tumours and disease exactly like the first one we saw, but has a separate origin. Mm-hmm. So it's also a cancer that first arose in one individual animal, yeah. this time a male, and spreads through the population by biting and causes tumours which look grossly really indistinguishable from the first transmissible cancer, but have a totally different origin. So it kind of changes now how we think about both Tasmanian devils and also transmissible cancers, mm-hmm. because suddenly they're much more common than we thought they were.
In such a small population of animals and in such a short period of time, it can't just be coincidence that you've ended up with those two transmissible cancers. Do we have any idea why that might have occurred? Do we think it might have occurred in the past and we don't know about it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I should start by saying that before 1996, there were no reports at all of mm-hmm. devils with tumours of this type, of a disease like this occurring in devils. So we had never really considered that this type of disease had happened before, and it was thought to be a kind of recent thing that had happened by chance. But now with the emergence of this second cancer, it makes us question that and actually makes us think, could this have happened in the past and not been observed or not been mm-hmm. reported? Alternatively, it's possible that something very new has happened, which has suddenly made Tasmanian devils very susceptible to this type of disease. So some kind of change in the environment might trigger this type of disease to emerge. So far, the work we've done doesn't really point to any clear answer for why this has happened, which to me makes me think that probably this has happened in the past. Mm-hmm. Europeans only came to Tasmania in the early 19th century. So it's possible over devil's evolutionary history, this type of disease might have happened many times. But that also raises the question, why are there devils? Because I mean, they have this really bad habit of biting each other. If they are so flawed at the kind of natural level, it seems very odd that they still exist. So there's many questions that we just don't have answers to at the moment.
Is there any hope for the devils? Do we know, are we going to see the whole species going extinct?
Well, it's really sad because, like I said, I'm from Tasmania, and in Tasmania there's a history of our unique native animals going extinct. Mm-hmm. You might have heard of the Tasmanian tiger, also called the thylacine, which was an even larger marsupial carnivore, and sadly it went extinct in the 1930s. And now the Tasmanian devil is the largest of the marsupial carnivores, and we kind of have a bit of a responsibility not to let them go the same way as the Tasmanian tiger. But now with this disease, there's a lot of uncertainty, or I should say these two diseases, there's a lot of uncertainty about their future. And at the moment, the main conservation efforts are to take Tasmanian devils and put them into sanctuaries, mm-hmm. Either on offshore islands or in wildlife parks or in large free-range enclosures with fences. And I guess whether there's any hope in terms of developing some kind of vaccine or prevention, it's still very early days, mm-hmm. and maybe something like that will come together in the next few years.
Okay, so moving away from the devils a little bit, we definitely know there is at least one species that has lived with a transmissible cancer for many, many years, and actually thousands of years, and that species has definitely not gone extinct, and that is dogs. Can you tell us a little bit more about this cancer in dogs and how it differs from the one we're seeing in the devils?
Yeah, so not many people know that dogs are actually host to transmissible cancer, the oldest transmissible cancer that we know of. It's a transmissible cancer which is spread by mating, mm-hmm. And just the same as with the devils, this dog cancer first arose in one individual dog and then managed to survive beyond that dog by the transmission of cancer cells from one dog to another, and now that one dog cancer has spread all around the world. So that first dog, as you mentioned, lived several thousand years ago, and the cancer that it spawned is still alive today and has spread literally everywhere around the world. And it's the most remarkable disease because it's just shown us that a cancer can survive for thousands, yeah. and thousands of years. And its host species, the dogs, obviously are doing, yeah. okay as well. So there seems to be a kind of mutual... they seem to have adapted to each other, I think, the cancer and the host, in such a way that both can coexist. Although it's still a problem in that it causes suffering to dogs, it's not the type of conservation problem that we, mm-hmm. see with the Tasmanian devils.
Do we know of any other examples of this very particular type of transmissible cancers?
So when I first started working on transmissible cancers more than 10 years ago, we only knew of two examples, yeah. the dogs, which were the old example, they'd been around for thousands of years, and then the brand new Tasmanian devil cancer. And then in 2014, we discovered the second transmissible, mm-hmm. cancer in devils. Around the same time, some colleagues in the US made this spectacular discovery that transmissible cancers appear to be fairly common in some species of marine mollusks, mm-hmm. Basically bivalves, which are clams, cockles. And so basically they found that various different bivalve species have transmissible cancers, which has spread actually through fairly large distances in these mollusk populations. And remarkably, they also recently found a transmissible cancer which had spread from one species of clam to another species. So this is a kind of mind-boggling discovery. And I guess mostly it's surprising because many people didn't even know that bivalves could get cancer. but they can. And it's a kind of leukemia-like disease. We don't actually know how the cell gets it from one individual into the next. So in the devils it's biting, in the dogs it's sexual transmission, in the clams obviously they are sessile animals, they don't, mm-hmm. move, and so it has to be the cancer cells that move. So it seems like it has to be the case that cancer cells get out of the host, float through the water, and then get taken up by another host. So it seems like there's probably transmissible cancer cells floating through the marine environment, which is quite a scary thought.
that's amazing. Yeah. Do we think it could happen in humans? Well, that's probably a question you get asked quite a lot.
Yeah. Well, the lucky thing is that there are no reports at present of transmissible cancers in, mm-hmm. humans. So there's no reports outside Tasmanian devils and dogs in the mammalian world. So it seems like even though it's happened twice in Tasmanian devils, it's probably still a fairly rare phenomenon in mammals in general. There's probably something about Tasmanian devils that make them more at risk. To me, it seems unlikely that an epidemic of transmissible cancer would emerge in humans, but it's not to say that it couldn't happen. Mm-hmm. And there have been a few examples of transmissible cancers that have spread between two different human individuals, but they're all kind of very unusual cases where some strange scenario has happened. So, for instance, there are cases with organ transplant mm-hmm. where organs have been donated and there was a cancer in there that wasn't previously diagnosed, and they can sometimes grow in the recipient. But again, they're all really rare, and they all involve a little bit of a strange mm-hmm. Scenario when it comes to the immune system.
Yeah.
So I guess the main thing about transmissible cancers is that makes them different to cancers that just remain in one host is firstly, they need to get out of a host and get into a new host, so they need to have a transmission mechanism, and secondly, they have to escape the immune system as a foreign graft. And probably those two things are fairly difficult to do. Mm-hmm. Maybe the Tasmanian devils, maybe because of the way they bite each other, or maybe because they're quite closely related because they live on this small island and they're fairly inbred. Maybe that gives those two mechanisms a good head start. And in other species, maybe it's just not very likely that, first of all, transmissible cancers, a cancer is going to have the opportunity to get from one host to another. And secondly, that if it does, is going to be able to escape from the immune system. So I don't know. I wouldn't be too worried about an epidemic of transmissible cancers in humans, but I think it is something that we need to bear in mind just in case something like that could occur.
If people want to learn any more about this topic, is where can they find additional information?
There's a TED Talk about it, and there's a website run by the Save the Tasmanian Devil program, which mm-hmm. is a conservation program based in Tasmania. They have quite a good website with quite a bit of information. www.tassiedevil.com.au, I think. And if anybody wants to come and talk to me about it, you're very welcome.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Okay, before we move on to our interview with Alison, we're going to go to the research highlights section of the podcast. Today, Emma's got some recent research on pupil sizes and learning. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. So it's a very recent paper. It came out in Nature Scientific Reports on March 21st. We're recording this on the 23rd, so it's really hot off the press. You probably know that pupils get bigger when it's darker, and they tend to get smaller if it's really bright. But actually, the light is not the only thing that can affect the size of your pupils. So what this group did was they wanted to look at the changes in pupil size when memorizing and recalling a list of words. So the experiment basically goes as follows. They took a group of 10 adults, which is a fairly small number, and they admit that themselves. And they first just did a countdown from 10 to kind of allow them to focus, pretty much, before displaying 12 words on a screen individually for about a second and a half each. And this is what they call the encoding phase. So after this, they made the individual solve a like simple mathematical equation to distract them and basically prevent them from just rehearsing the list of words that they've just seen. And finally, they asked them to recall as many words as possible in any order that they want. And throughout the entire process, they tracked the individual's pupil size. And actually, it was remarkably consistent across the entire experiment. And so you see this consistent pattern, which is that during the initial fixation phase, the pupils tended to be constricted. So that's when they were at the smallest. And then during the encoding and then distracting and recalling phase, you see the pupils get gradually more dilated. So the interesting thing was the scientists then wanted to see whether there was any correlation between the pupil size and how well a word is actually remembered. And there is. So if you can actually see quite clearly in the data that if a word is successfully retained, the pupils is more constricted before the onset of the word presentation and then more dilated afterwards, which wow. I thought was really cool.
Yeah, wow. That is really cool. And that's already like a thing, right, in this kind of research, pupil size correlating with various brain functions.
Yeah, so actually there is definitely a precedent for this. So there are experiments that like date back to the 60s, for example, that have shown, for example, that pupil dilation can indicate an interest in the content of a presented visual stimuli. There was another experiment that showed that pupil size changes when you make someone calculate like basic multiplications. And actually, really cool. The change is kind of directly correlated with the difficulty of the problem that the individual is asked to solve, which is cool. There was more recently, I think it was in 2010, there's a group that showed that you could use changes in pupil size as like a predictive marker for decision making. So if you ask an individual, for example, to press a button whenever they want within a 10 second time window, you will see basically the pupil dilating when they make the decision, so like just before they press the button.
Oh wow.
So they kind of like get betrayed by their pupils. So I mean, like, all of this tells us you can see, you can use pupil responses to obtain sort of information on many brain processes, which can be involved in, you know, perception, attention, decision making, so that kind of stuff. And so this particular study that I just talked about suggests that you could possibly use pupil size as a biomarker for memory processing, for example, and learning. So yeah, that's it.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Well, moving on from the predictive qualities of dilating pupils then, to an interview with a person whose pupils might dilate if you were to mention ice shelves. I interviewed Alison Banwell, a glaciologist at the Scott Pillar Research Institute in Cambridge, as I've mentioned. I'd like to note, before we begin, that I was interviewing Alison not only for the podcast, but also for a Blue Sky article that's being written as I speak into this microphone. It'll be out in the Easter term issue, so look out for that in April and May, coming to a department near you and on our website, bluesci.co.uk. So this interview is a bit of a personal profile of Alison, asking her about her research as well as her experience of field work at the polar extremes. All right, so we're sitting here in the Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge. I'm with Dr. Alison Banwell. And that's it. So, Alison, do you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your work?
Sure. So, yeah, I'm a postdoctoral researcher here at Scott Polar Research Institute. I've been here almost 10 years. I first arrived in 2008 when I started my PhD, which was looking at water flow across and under the Greenland ice sheet. I then spent a year in Chicago and got really interested in Antarctic ice shelf stability, so the floating bits of ice around the Antarctic continent. And that year really kind of spiraled all the research that I've done since. So I then moved back to Cambridge and continued to study Antarctic ice shelves, so how they become unstable and why and how they're likely to break up, why they have done in the past and why they may in the future.
So it's Antarctic fieldwork mostly. Have you done Arctic fieldwork as well?
Yeah, so during my PhD I went to Greenland twice on expeditions to look at the lakes on the surface of the Greenland ice sheet, to monitor their rapid drainage. So sometimes they're found to drain all the way down to the bed of the ice sheet and cause big increases in ice velocities when they do that. Difference is that Greenland is mostly grounded on bedrock.
Okay.
Most of the ice sheet is on rock. There are a few floating areas around the edge, which are confusingly called tongues, whereas in Antarctica they're called shelves, but they're the same. But right, there's only five significant tongues in Greenland, whereas Antarctica's got maybe 100 ice shelves or more of different sizes around the edge.
Your research specifically then on the Antarctic ice shelves. So
yeah,
what is it exactly that you do then?
Yeah, so I specifically became interested in the effects of what happens when lakes on ice shelves either drain or fill. So the weight of meltwater acts as a load. So therefore, if you either add a load to an ice shelf or you remove it, there's big changes in the stress that can occur as a result of adding or removing that load. Probably like the most significant research I've been involved with was back in 2013, when we showed that, so there was a big breakup of a particular ice shelf in 2002, the Larsen B ice shelf, and it was shown that in a few weeks before the breakup, over 2,000 lakes drained on the surface, and various people have suspected that the ice shelf broke up in response to those 2,000 lakes draining, but no one could really explain why. And we tried to explain why that happened through a kind of chain reaction lake drainage scenario, meaning that one or more random lakes drained and the effect of those lakes draining caused other lakes to drain because they caused fractures to form in the bottoms of other lakes. So it's like this kind of self-propagating effect of lots of lakes draining, more fractures forming, more lakes draining, and kind of so on. So we conducted a modelling study to show that the breakup of the Larsen B ice shelf may have been shown through this chain reaction event. So that was kind of a big modelling study, but then we didn't have any field data to kind of test the models. No one had any field data. No one's really studied lakes on ice shelves, or hadn't, until the past two seasons. We went down to Antarctica and went to the McMurdo ice shelf that's on the edge of the Ross ice shelf to look at surface lakes there. And we deployed various instruments. In particular, we deployed pressure transducers to measure lake depth over time for a melt season. So we put the pressure sensors in the lakes, and then they showed how much a lake was filling or draining. And we also deployed an array of GPS receivers, which were drilled on which were fixed to poles that were drilled into the ice. And they're really high-precision GPS, so they showed their accuracy is less than a centimetre once you've corrected them. The differential GPSs, you correct them against a base station on the land, on the rock. And then those GPS could show how much the ice was flexing in response to the lakes filling. So we've got a nice data set of lakes filling and GPSs going down due to the weight of water and then coming up as the lakes drain.
How big are the lakes?
They can be various sizes. On this particular ice shelf, they were up to maybe a kilometre across, kilometre in diameter. They're quite large. There are lakes that have been observed on other ice shelves, like the Amory ice shelf, which is kind of on the opposite side of the continent to McMurdo, that may be 10 kilometres across. But then some ice shelves weren't really lakes at all. It all depends on how much surface melting is going on. And they don't tend to be that deep. The deepest we measured was about 3 metres.
Okay.
So you're not going to drown in them. Well, I guess you would if you were swimming in a 3 metre lake.
They're more like a huge puddle.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Enough to go boating on, but we didn't. We had kind of enormous fishing waders to go into the lakes to collect instruments at the end of the season, which looked quite funny. One of our lakes was called the Wrong Trousers from Wallace and Gromit reference.
Yeah.
If anyone's aware of that, because we had to wear these big fishing waders.
Did the weather impact on your work much?
Occasionally. Well, so we had these two field deployments, as you call them. In the early season, there's lots of sea ice, which meant that we could get to the field site on skidoos and what's called piston bullies. They're like small piece bashers that you see in ski resorts. And you can drive those vehicles across the sea ice, and you can do that in most conditions unless it's what's called condition 3, which means you're not allowed to leave the building in the base. So we mostly got out most days then. But then when we picked up the instruments, the sea ice had either melted or was too thin to drive vehicles on it. So we had to use helicopters to get to field sites each day, which meant that whenever the weather was at all dodgy, or even if it was just misty, the helicopter didn't fly. So we lost lots of days due to weather, because you need perfect conditions for helicopters. They don't like to use GPS, or they don't rely on GPS. They're like, the pilot always wants to see where he's going. They don't want to take any risks, which is fair enough.
Yeah, probably a good idea. So, you like the fieldwork, you know, you want to go again?
Yeah, I'd like to go again. We're trying to write more grant proposals to go again. Mm. We're planning to maybe go to a different ice shelf next time. We're not quite sure where. Maybe one on the peninsula, so the Antarctic Peninsula, the bit that sticks out in West Antarctica, which is the area that's most prone to melting, to global warming. It's the area that's warming the fastest. So it's kind of the ice shelves around that area that are more vulnerable than other ice shelves. So they're going to have more meltwater lakes. But logistically, it's harder to get to. You can't really stay in a field base. You have to be in the deep field, as we call it. You have to camp and get all the equipment flown in and then get collected a few weeks later. So it's much more expensive and more logistically complicated. Yeah, but that's the plan if we get a grant funded. McMurdo is great because you can stay in McMurdo Station, which is the American base, and you can have hot showers every day and there's 24-hour pizza and burgers. So it's quite a nice life, really.
I wondered about that. Because I've heard about McMurdo, the city and Antarctica sort of thing. It's got a population of 1,000 or 2,000 people, right?
Yeah, about 1,000 maximum in the summer.
Okay, right.
And it goes down to maybe 100 in the winter.
Right. People stay there all year.
Yeah, wow. Some people need to just keep the station running. They have, I don't know, various scientific experiments going on in the winter that need to keep going.
I'd have wondered about that, because with a population that size, everyone can't be a scientist.
Yeah, so only like 10% of the population are scientists, especially in the summer. In fact, even less than that, because, yeah, so the population is 1,000, but that 1,000 actually includes lots of people who are out at field camps in the nearby area, within like 100 kilometres.
Right.
And a lot of those people will be the scientists. So actually, you've probably only got 5% of the station scientists, and the other 5% around the field camps.
Mm.
Yeah, so it is like a small city. I mean, after a month of being there, I still didn't recognise most people that I walked past, like on the way to the dining hall. And there's kind of everything you might want there, or most things. There's like a couple of bars, there's a chapel. There used to be a bowling alley, but they got rid of it because it fell down, I think. The building became derelict. There's three gyms, including like a big indoor football sports hall.
Wow.
And a very small climbing wall. So, yeah, there's lots to do. A library for interreading.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then just like freely available food whenever you want it. So it's possible to get quite fat there. You see lots of fat people.
Even burning all those calories outside. Then.
Yeah, but not everyone does that. A lot of people just stay inside. So some people, I don't know, working in kitchens, working in the... There's loads of different jobs. There's a huge wastewater management plant that people work in. Other people running the planes, looking after vehicles. There'll be outdoor jobs. Yeah, there's a huge mix of people down there.
Do you have any particularly memorable experiences from your fieldwork?
Sinking a skidoo, that was quite amusing. I drove a skidoo or snowmobile into a large, what I thought was an ice-covered lake or ice, but it must have been a lake covered in very thin ice, and the whole thing just collapsed through the ice and I got totally drenched. And the skidoo had to be pulled out by an enormous tractor. Luckily, it was right next to the airport on the ice shelf, or the airstrip, so there were lots of vehicles around to pull me up.
Mm.
That's quite amusing. It's fun to meet penguins. They're quite inquisitive, so they kind of waddle up and see what you're doing often. They say don't go nearer than 5 meters to wildlife, but often they come up to you because they're interested, so that rule kind of doesn't really apply because they're not really used to seeing people. But they don't have any threats. No, that's not predators, penguins, so they're not really scared of anything. Apart from leopard seals, we don't get leopard seals in that area of Antarctica at least, so they're really not scared of anything.
You said you were trying to understand the breakup of the Larsen ice shell.
Yeah,
Larsen B.
Larsen B.
You're more involved in sort of understanding ice dynamics than sort of a future modelling or something, predictions?
Both, really, but the models I run are mostly quite small scale, quite theoretical. I wouldn't run. Yeah, we did run a model for the Larsen B, but it was very theoretical in the sense that it didn't have a time dependency, so we weren't running it. We didn't run it through time. A lot of the models I run are just, say, for one lake on ice to try and simulate the processes of what's going on. And then it's often up to other people to apply those processes into larger models. The small models are also good because you can take, for example, field data to try and like parameterize the various variables in the model. Because if you're running something much bigger, you couldn't do that as easily. But yeah, ultimately, all the research I'm doing and lots of other glaciologists here will ultimately be used by climate modelers and ice sheet modelers initially, to model how much ice is going to end up in the ocean, and then ultimately climate modelers to look at the effect on changing climate on what the ice sheets are going to do, and then model global sea level rises in response. So yeah, there's lots of like down the line processes that I don't have anything to do with.
What's your opinion then? Because more and more now you hear some people saying that climate modelling, you know, oh, it's just people sitting in an office somewhere designing a system to say what they think the results should be.
What's going to happen? I don't know. There's so many people working on like the inputs to models like that that, yeah, I think they're pretty reliable, to be honest. And they don't just give one outlook. They have lots of outlook based on various temperature rises. And then based on those temperature changes, the models can produce different outputs. So it's not like climate models are saying this is definitely going to happen. There's always a kind of a broad spectrum, kind of the worst case scenario and the best case scenario. Mm. And as time goes on, I'm sure they're becoming more and more reliable as computer capacity becomes larger and there's more and more people working kind of the background processes that are feeding into the models. But, yeah, good question. But yeah, I don't work with any climate modelers directly, so I don't know particularly.
Here's potentially a tough question. If you could unlock one piece of knowledge about your field for free, what would it be and why?
Unlock one bit of knowledge? Like, how long will it be before Antarctica doesn't have any ice shelves? That would be a sad situation. So yeah, I should have said earlier, ice shelves are important because they buttress the inland glaciers from flowing into the ocean. Ice shelves themselves, because they're floating in the ocean, when they melt, they're not going to contribute to sea level rise because they're already in the ocean. They're already floating. But if they go, then the inland ice accelerates and it's that ice that will contribute to sea level rise. So yeah, when the ice shelves go, it'll be a pretty sad state of affairs.
Yeah, because all of Antarctica would start just
flowing outwards. And if they didn't reform, it would just keep, would be like really positive feedback effect, it would just speed up forevermore. It'd be interesting to know whether the whole Earth is going to plunge into another ice age at some point, before all the ice shelves melt.
Thanks for talking to us, Alison.
No problem, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for coming.
All right.
Okay, so thanks again to Alison for the interview and to Liz, who we heard from earlier. So that's the end of our show. Before we go, we've had a question from a listener who was a little confused as to how the title of the podcast is pronounced.
Yeah, so this is something I actually struggle with myself. So you might have noticed sometimes I tend to pronounce Blue Sky differently, as either Blue Sky, Blue Ski, or even Blue Sky. That sort of varies between people who work for our society, and I don't think there's really an overall agreement about how it's actually meant to be pronounced. The one that might be non-obvious to a listener if you're not from Cambridge is Blue Ski, which is based on people pronounce a natural sciences course here as Nat Ski, so we say Blue Ski for Psy becomes Ski for no reason. But we're trying to standardize it for this podcast as Blue Psy, because I think we both think that makes the most sense.
Yeah.
We're going to try and do that, but if you hear them all in the future, apologies in advance.
Okay. Thanks for clearing that up-ish. So, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send us an email at bluesipodcast@gmail.com, and you can also find us on Twitter at bluesipod. Thanks, guys.
Okay, thank you. See you next time.
See you next time.